This is an interview for the Special Collections Library section of the UT Arlington Chicano Studies Program. Subject is Alberto Loera, the interviewer is José Ángel Gutiérrez. And Mr. Loera, you are consenting to this interview of your own free will, and you're giving this videotape unedited and transcription unedited to be placed in a collection in the series on Mexican-American politics in Texas.
Yes, sir, I am.
All right, today is June the 10th. It's 11:30. We're in the offices of Centro Aztlán, which is a building and business occupied and run by Mr. Loera in Laredo, Texas. The physical address is
406 Scott. Here in Laredo, Texas, and it is 1986.
All right. Let's start out with your biography on your parents' father's side. Who's your grandparents? Where did they come from?
Paternal grandparents, Apolinar, Luera, y Petra Zapata.
Go ahead.
I got a phone call.
Confirming another interview. All right, your Zapata was your grandmother. Where were they born?
Real del 14, San Luis Potosí, in Mexico.
Both of them.
Both of them, according to legend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did they come over this way?
At the turn of the century. Probably around 1900 to 1902.
Reasons?
My grandfather was a miner, and obviously it seemed that the miner's job in Real del 14, which as we're all very well aware, has been a mining community since even before the Spaniards came. I guess the mines went down and he came over and was working originally at the coal mines in Dolores upstream. And then after that, he became an ice cream vendor.
Okay.
So he sold ice cream at the corner of Scott and San Eduardo, a block and a half from here, from 1922 until the ice cream business went bust, which is hard to say when.
How many children they have?
What I remember alive, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Eligio, María Luisa, Albino, Eugenio, Polo, y Emeregilda. 6 children.
Your father was one of them. He was the oldest, the middle, youngest?
He would have been the third oldest. He was number 3 in La Linea. And he was born in 1905 on Zaragoza Street, not far from here, about 100 yards on this side of El Rio Grande.
And on your mother's side, grandparents, where are they from?
Grandparents, Marcelo Hernandez y Maria Guerra. They basically were, as far as I can tell, they were both born in Villa de Mina, Nuevo León, which is up the mountain from Monterrey, Mexico. About half an hour's bus ride. They were both, they came to this country right at the start of the revolution.
Reasons?
My father's brother was El General Hernandez, with a lot of connections in Crystal City, with Crystal City revolutionaries. He was the general that was blown, that was killed by, you have that tape of that, no, you don't have that tape of that interview. He was killed outside of, somewhere south of here, when that particular general decided to change from being a Carrancista to a Villista. And several viejitos from Crystal City, they went back to join him And one of those viejitos llegó para enterrarlos.
Because they got ambushed that night.
Actually, that's why my grandfather came over, porque su hermano estaba metido en la revolución y se vinieron para acá.
Okay, but we're talking about your mother's side.
Yes, Hernández.
But you can say your father's brother.
My mother's father's brother.
Okay, your mother's father's
brother. My grandfather's brother. Right. My granduncle.
All right, okay.
Eduardo Hernández was his name, and that's one of the reasons why they're over here, porque se metió bien pesado en la revolución, and they came over to Laredo.
Okay. So how did your parents meet?
Oh, this is how I venture to say it, because that's how I remember it. My grandfather had a grocery store.
Which one?
Hernández, Marcelo Hernández had a grocery store down the street from here. And my father met my mother through the grocery store, because he used to go ir a comprar.
Okay.
And my mother was the cashier at the grocery store.
When did they marry, do you know?
When did they marry? Yeah, they married on October the 14th, 1945.
How many children they have?
Three children. Me being the oldest, I was born in July the 21st of 1946. Two sisters, Irma, May 10th, 1948, and Petra, May 8th, May 7th. Y Petra, the youngest, November 15th, 1951.
And those two sisters live where now?
In Dallas, and they're both teachers, and they've been there for many years.
Okay. Was your father or mother involved in Laredo politics?
None at all. Nothing whatsoever.
They become citizens of the United States?
They were both citizens of the United States. They were born here, both of them.
That's right.
Yeah, they were born here, both of them.
Now let's talk about your particular personal family. You got married, been married, married again. What's your marital status?
I am currently married to my second spouse, Josefina Chavez. And we have a son, Daniel, 3 years old. I am... My first spouse, Juanita Bustamante, Asherton. We have one son, Gabriel, and they both live in San Antonio.
Juanita was from Asherton.
Yeah, now she lives in San Antonio. She's lived in San Antonio for many years.
And do you have any children with her?
Gabriel, one child.
Okay. Switching now to your first recollection of something political.
I kind of became active in politics, believe it or not, when I was in junior high school. And I already had a little bit of political notions of things were not right back then. And I remember the biggest political thing when I was in the eighth grade was the Viva Kennedy clubs. And everybody at the schools were involved with the Viva Kennedy clubs. So I joined the Nixon campaign for president in 1959. So that was my first involvement in politics.
What made you go against the current?
Because everybody was for Kennedy, I had to be for Nixon.
How old were you? Well, when were you born?
I was born on July the 21st, 1946. So that was what, 13 years old when I had my first taste of politics, and I actually wore a Nixon button, and I got harassed by the rest of the little Kennedy people when we were in eighth grade. I hate to admit this. I was involved in elementary school in the little elections and for the little class, for the class queen and the class prince and the king and that kind of stuff. I was, you know, I kind of got involved in public activities back then when I was in elementary school. Just my personality, I guess.
Any church involvement?
Very little. I was a regular church goer, but I never really became involved in church activities per se. I mean,
denomination?
Catholic, Roman Catholic.
All right, and then what was the next experience you remember?
Well, I guess as I kind of grew older and became immersed in high school and began taking political courses, government and history and that kind of stuff, I kind of became very aware of what democracy was, and I kind of felt that Laredo politics was not very democratic. I mean, as I grew up, I understood that it was a one-party system. I mean, and that only the same people always got elected, and I felt that that was not right. As a matter of fact, I remember when there was no contrarios.
Are you referring to a local machine?
Local machine,
the Democratic Party?
No, I was referring to the local machine.
Who was the boss then?
Pepe Martin, forever. I mean, for my growing up.
Was he Anglo or Mexican-American?
Pepe Martin's grandfather was a French immigrant that came to Laredo in the late 1880s from France. A very young man, as far as I can remember in the history books, a very young man who married a local person and had children, and all the children married local persons. So Pepe Martin had probably 125% of French foreign blood. So I would consider him pretty much a Mexicano, local Mexicano person who had the name of Pepe Joe C. Martin Jr. And that's one of the things about Laredo politics and Webb County politics and South Texas politics. I mean, the political machine was the political machine, and in many respects is still the political machine, dominated by Mexican Americans from top to bottom, all the way from up there down to the bottom. And it's based on patronage, hence the patron system, and it's based on jobs and favors and families. And unfortunately, there's not enough room for everybody in that kind of a system, so there were a lot of people left out. And that has created the inequities in the South Texas political system. And I figured that out very young, and that's how I got involved in politics, kind of.
What did you do, kind of?
I decided that social activism was a way to really affect politics, and as I got into college and was coming up at that right point in time in history, in the evolution of the politics of this country, I ended up being right there in the middle of the 60s, complaining about the political system and doing something about it, taking it out to the street and being a social activist. And that's how I decided that for the rest of my life I could do something to change the situation in our communities in this part of the world and make it better for a bigger number of people.
Why did you go to college?
I guess in my upbringing, within my mother and my father, there was no other, that was the choice. That was the choice. There was no other choice in my upbringing than to pursue my education until I graduated from the university.
What were you going to
do? Period. I mean, there was never in my mind, as a matter of fact, in the few instances that I was able to communicate with my father was older, much older, was a very old person by the time I came around. In other words, my father was 41 when I was born, and he was in his late 50s by the time I was a being, que ya sabía lo que pasaba. There was very little communications. I remember once asking him, when I was still in high school, what was he, a Democrat or a Republican? As materials were coming into the house to vote, either for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, I remember asking him, and in his classical answering of questions, he guffawed. And that was his answer to my question whether he was a Democrat or Republican. So I really did not have any political guidance. When I asked him about work and what should I be, he did not answer. But when I said, give me a chance at your job, at your work, I can go there and do things, he said, not. So he never allowed me to go and work at the furniture store where he worked. My mother also would not allow me to go work anywhere. I remember que venían las trocas de las piscas right here in front of the boys club across the street from my house to pick up the neighborhood kids to go piscar melons. They would not allow me to go pick piscar melons. And my mother was always saying, no, you're not going to go because if you do, you might get the feel for money and you're not going to go to school. So while everybody in the neighborhood, being teenagers, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, would go a las piscas and pick up some pocket money, I would not. I felt a little discriminated because, well, I felt a little, not discriminated, a little, como se dice, my opportunity was not being given to me by my parents to go make some money so I could go and spend money like the rest of the kids. But she kept saying, you go to school, you go to school, you go to school. Then I ended up in school. When I ended up, what did I want to do when I graduated from college, or as I was going to college, answering the second part of your question was, I wanted to be a teacher. And then, so I started junior college here in Laredo to be a teacher, and then I wanted to be a biology teacher. So I kind of tracked myself into biology. And obviously I did not end up being a biology teacher. I ended up being a social worker.
Were you active in politics in Laredo Junior College or Kingsville? Where did you end up?
Became getting involved in politics at Kingsville. Actually, politics. I remember here in junior college, there was a small group of us that, and this was just as the movement was getting started, as the Valley Farm workers in the 67, the march up to Austin. Those were the first Mexicano type of movements that I began to see and became conscious. See, the biggest thing in my mind is that I did not become conscious of my being a Mexicano until I left Laredo. I had always seen and I had always viewed the flyboys as being foreigners from another world, and the few black people that came to Laredo on their yearly, summer sojourns into Mexico were very few apart. I mean, I saw very few blacks during my growing up, and very few white people also, because Laredo is a Mexicano town, and in this particular neighborhood where we're at right now, where I was born and grew up and raised, you didn't see them. Television was the white. That's our peek into the white world, and we saw it as very far away. So I was very Mexicano growing up and being involved in everything. So my first consciousness of politics as Mexicanos were concerned were really at ANI. But the little actividad that we were talking here at the community college were pláticas without politics. you mentioned Tigre Perez that just passed away last year. Tigre was one of the guys. We became friends at college. Poncho Ruiz from Houston, one of the old Mayo guys. There was a group, Bobby Mendoza, who's a teacher here. There was a group, Chaka and the brothers, Ramirez. We were here at the community college beginning to talk about things that were not necessarily politics, but just inequities as what we saw here in Laredo. Obviously, those inequities of the poverty and the school dropout issues and all of those things that became focused at ANI with your insights to a lot of this stuff and everybody else that kind of was involved in before my time, those few years before us, kind of crystallized that it was a big problem. It wasn't just us here in Laredo because of Laredo. It was big.
When you were here in this Mexican Laredo, were you aware of the other Laredo, and how did that border dynamics? Did you have friends from the other side of the border? Did you ever go across the river?
I went across the border very few times. My going to Nuevo Laredo became going to Nuevo Laredo after I was an older teenager. All I know was that it was another country and that I really didn't have any connections in Nuevo Laredo. There was one family, which were compadres de mi papá, that we used to go visit once a year, maybe. And that was it. So I didn't really have very little contact with the other Laredo, which is south of the Rio Grande, mm-hmm. up until Ya Grandes. And obviously we went cruising Nuevo Laredo. I mean, you know, that's what we did. It wasn't because of relationships or family ties. A group of us neighborhood kids would go to Nuevo Laredo a dar la vuelta. I mean, we found Nuevo Laredo, La Guerrero, and we'd go cruising just to go cruising also, you know. So I really didn't start going to Nuevo Laredo until I was, until I was really in at the university, yeah. Cuando íbamos al otro lado a traer mandado, we used to go bring stuff, foodstuffs from Nuevo Laredo because they were cheaper. Pero to have political relationships or friends and or things like that, no.
What were some of the first political experiences you had at ANI?
Well, again, going to Kingsville, probably the biggest thing that happened that slammed me smack in the face was being fairly congenial. You know, I was one of those persons that could come up to a stranger and strike up a conversation about the weather or anything. And that's what we did here a lot. I mean, people here in Laredo would say hi, good morning, and just make a comment about whatever the weather or anything. And people would respond. And in Kingsville, that wasn't the case. I saw foreigners in my eyes, all those cowboys out there, gorrudos, and I would say hi to them or mention something, and they would turn away. It was very interesting because this whole concept of Anglo-Mexican relationships struck me in the face. What's wrong with this guy? I mean, I said good morning. I mean, don't decent people say good morning to each other? And it wasn't. I guess that was the first political experience, knowing, understanding that there was whites and blacks and Mexicans in this world, and that not all of us were accordingly created equal. I found out another thing that was very interesting. When I ended up at Kingsville, see, I mean, you know, the here in Laredo, I started... Martin High School was the high school I went to. And Martin High School was just like that.
Like that.
It meant that, I mean, it was a small, it was a fairly small school, and everybody went to that school. The ones that did not go to Martin High School, which is the public high school, went to the Catholic school. There was maybe one or two or three blacks in the whole school. There was probably 100 Anglos in the whole school. There was 3,000 Mexican Americans in the whole school. So it was very homogeneous. It was a homogeneous school. So you talked to everybody and everybody got along. And the few blacks that were in town knew how to speak Spanish. And obviously the few Anglos that were in town spoke Spanish. And there was very little of this I'm better than thou attitude at Martin back then in the early 60s. When I ended up at ANI, for some reason or another, I found out that not only were there blacks, not only were there whites, but there were a few Mexicanos that acted like whites and would not talk Spanish, even though we all knew they did. They were from that side of town, if I may use that concept. Me being a barrio cat, with a capital K, growing up in this neighborhood among La Palomilla, was not familiar. I mean, I never really went out of my neighborhood. I didn't get to know how the better part of town, the better part of the Mexican Americans in this community lived, because I never traveled to those neighborhoods. Another political awareness that I became of is that not all of us think the same, and I always thought they did. So those were the first awakenings of politics. And I need to point out, because it's important, the character of political activists. All of these perceptions were never personal. They were observations. I never took any of all of these experiences in politics, I never took them as personal, and I never in my mind aspired to be better than them. Which now in my maturity, a lot of us that went out became worse than them, in their zeal to be better than what they thought were being discriminated against. You know, that's not one, that's politics. So that's why I guess I'm still here. I mean, I'm a block away, a block and a half away from where I was born and raised, and in my neighborhood with the same old viejitos that, you know, that been here all my life, that I've known forever. So I don't know. I mean, it goes back to the same concept de la política. ¿Qué estamos haciendo? And how can we best direct our activities and working with people so that we don't create the same problem that we're trying to... I don't know, man. You know, so, no sé, Ángel. I guess as... 1960, going back as 1967, as I went to ANI in 1967, I was already a junior. I had 2 years to go. I came in at ANI and I met a lot of young people from throughout South Texas. My first pulse of the movement was within the first couple of weeks when I got into Kingsville, when I rented a place. One of my roommates, who was a Crystal City person from your hometown, we became close friends because he was pretty much like me. We talked the same way. We were barrio cats, Ezequiel Guzman. And La Chumina, as we called them, had a whole bunch of history about the Crystal City experience in the late 60s and 70s. And then with the Paso group being there, it just became a natural. Eventually, I ended up going to the meetings and meeting all the guys that were involved in Paso.
This is on the campus?
At the campus, the campus group. And I became one of the activist supporters, involvers.
You didn't join the Laredo Club?
I was in the Laredo Club. Very interesting you asked that question. I was in the Laredo Club with only Laredo people. Me being the gregarious myself, ran for political office in the Laredo Club. I don't remember if it was secretary or treasurer, one of those work positions. And I was soundly defeated, man, like 40-2 or 40-3 votes. And, you know, I obviously felt, you know, after that experience, I said, I guess I'm not going to be a popular person with the Laredo, my Laredo constituents. So I remember that, yeah. I joined the Laredo Club and I ran for a little political office and I was soundly defeated by...
Any thoughts as to why the students from Laredo, when they go to colleges, form a Laredo Club? They're everywhere. It's the only people from any town that I know that form a town club.
I don't know, man. I would, you know, thinking about it, I would venture to say that it was in that time, at that time, a very self-assuring type of an endeavor. Again, you know, I would imagine that my experience, my Laredo one, going out into the world experience, is been, I have gone through these experiences. Probably the experiences I went through, probably everybody from this town, living this town, went through those experiences. And living home, living Laredo, living Mexican Laredo into the gringo world out there can be pretty shaking. And us Laredo ones being a sheltered, a very sheltered community. I mean, period. I mean, I think it would be a natural to form a Laredo Club as a self-reassuring support, self-support. I know for a fact that all the move. Mira, por ejemplo, we commuted, all of us commuted back and forth weekends, every weekend. I mean, every weekend. Some people even commuted 2 or 3 times a week. The cars, not everybody had cars and everybody, I mean, so there was a system of activities that was happening within Laredo people. I'm sure that just not when I was going to school, but also when the previous generations were coming to college, it would be a natural to have that kind of support for transportation, for friendship, for social activities. Kingsley wasn't bad. I mean, there was Mexicanos from Alice and Mexicanos from San Diego and Mexicanos from Zapata and from El Valle. But if you went to UT Austin or if you went to Texas A&M or not North Texas State, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, very, very few Mexicanos. And it was just a natural, I think it's just a natural to form a Laredo Club. And it's a natural, it's obvious for what reasons. And while there's a little bit of politics, potential political innuendos there, I think it was more for self-protection, self-preservation, and mutual assistance.
What were some of the things that Paso at A&I did when you were a member? Who were the leaders?
I think that the Paso group in Kingsville had been in existence already for several years. I kind of feel that when I went to A&I, a generation of Paso, the founders, the original group had already pretty much graduated, and we were in the second group of newer people coming in. One of the things about Paso was that it was fairly informal when I joined the group. And I felt they didn't have elections for officers. That was a difference. That was a difference in the group. I mean, the officers were not that. The spokesman of the group when I was at ANI was Carlos Guerra. And while there would have been other spokespeople that could speak, most of the members would defer to Carlos to make the political statements that were given to the press or the school or whatever. Carlos was pretty much the spokesperson, the leader of the group. Victor Nelson was involved in the group. Tony Bill, Diana Franco, Lupe Youngblood. There's a lot of other people. I just can't think of them right now.
What was some of these?
We were in the... We kind of had an activity, the activities of addressing petitions to the campus and doing the newspaper and trying to get the Texas A&I University to be more responsive to Hispanics. At that point in time, 20-some-odd years ago, we were Chicanos. I don't know how we end up changing our name every 10, 15 years. But the Chicanos, we were trying to get the administration to bring in Hispanic activities, Hispanic studies, Chicano studies, Chicano history. And at the same time, the high school students and the junior high school students at the Kingsville Independent School District were beginning to mobilize to claim the rights also as students and as Chicanos. So we were also working with the high school students and junior high school students to do activities to change the school system, both at the Kingsville Independent School District and also at Texas A&I University. So that was our involvement. We kind of graduated into politics because we felt that that was a needed activity. Believe it or not, we ended up working for State Representative Carlos Truan to get elected. I remember going house to house in Kingsville trying to get Carlos to be elected as a state representative. As you're well aware, as we're all well aware, he's still in politics and he's the dean of the Texas Senate right now. That's almost 30 years ago. So we were involved in little politics here and there, school issues and local politics.
How did it come to be that you joined up with MAYO, the Mexican American Youth Organization?
Everybody felt that Paso was MAYO, that MAYO was an offshoot of Paso to a certain extent, plus the injection of the San Antonio militant group at the college, at St. Mary's. Nacho Perez, Mario Compián, Profe Alemán, Juan Patlán, Willie Velázquez, yourself, that San Antonio group was like pretty much, which are the founders of MAYO, that Paso was pretty much MAYO. And it was a natural. I mean, I graduated from Texas A&I University, and we moved to Corpus. Several of us moved into Corpus Christi. We were working with some other federal programs out there with a specific purpose of organizing Mexican American Youth Organization.
Who is we?
At that point in time, it was Viviana Santiago, Guadalupe Youngblood, Carlos Guerra, and myself. We moved to Corpus to try and work some kind of activity to get youth organized in Corpus and try and start up some youth groups in the Corpus Christi area, because Corpus was very behind in its times, and there was practically no political activity in Corpus, and we felt that would be a good avenue to work out. I guess the most important thing to answer your question as to why Mayo, in my mind, I made a decision graduating from the university as to what was I going to do pretty much with the rest of my life. And my idea that I was going to do organizing activities in Corpus pretty much decided that I was not going to go out and get your traditional job at a school district, given that back then you went to university to graduate to go get a teaching job. And at that point in time, I decided pretty much that I was not going to be a teacher in a school system, and that I was going to go out and do community organizing type of an activity, community work, social work, activism, movement type stuff. And this is where I've been. I mean, this is where I'm at still, almost 30 years afterwards. I made a decision. So my joining of Mayo was really, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life type of a situation. And I'm still here.
What were some of the things you all did in Corpus?
I went to work for SER, which was the first manpower program in the country. It was a manpower program in where the federal government was contracting with an Hispanic organization, and this was a corporation put together by LULAC and GI Forum to do manpower activities. I guess it was part of this set-asides of the 60s, the Johnson era, and that kind of stuff. So that federal programs would reach the Hispanic community. I was doing job training. I was officially doing job training in the classroom, but we were out in the community doing work in our off times.
What were you doing?
We started working with a Vista project, working with young people out in the Molina neighborhood to try and put youth groups together. I remember one of the younger kids that was very active, Armando Estrella, which he passed away 7 or 8 years ago in Minnesota. I heard about it. He turned out to be a very good artist and was very active in Chicano politics. We also were very much involved with the garbage union, garbage workers' strike out there, with a gentleman by the name of Arturo Casillas. I don't know what happened to him. That was pretty much it. I have to understand that I was in Corpus for 6 months. So that all of that little activism, that whatever I did in that period of time was in a 6 month period of time. After that, we started appearing. See, it was a very interesting situation, because we started appearing in the media, in the news, in the TV station. There was several stories about Mayo workers, Mayo organizers in Corpus, and we started getting our picture in the TV. And I remember I was hauled in with the chairman of SER in Corpus. And ultimately, I got fired. Pretty much, I got fired by Willy Bonilla, because he was getting pressured by the local politicians about this radical group of Kingsville graduates, which was Carlos Guerra, Guadalupe Youngblood, Viviana Santiago, and Alberto Loera, rabble-rousing, and that obviously they did not want us in the community, and that, you know, that maybe we should, maybe the program should get start releasing us. And I know for a fact that myself and Viviana were immediately dismissed. And Carlos and Guadalupe remained for a few more months, and then eventually they were fired. But it was very interesting, you know. So I moved on.
Where did you go?
I ended up with the Winter Garden Organizing Project in Crystal City under the direction of Jose Angel Gutierrez.
What did you do there?
I did a couple of things. The La Verdad newspaper was the big information instrument there for the community. I helped Luz with the newspaper. I forget I was getting printed, what, every 2 weeks? Every week, más o menos? I don't remember, but we were doing the newspaper. Also, because the Winter Garden Project was an organizing project, a political organizing project, I was voter registering. I was assigned to go out and register people in the outlying areas, Batesville and La Pryor. And I did a lot of voter registration out there in Batesville and La Pryor. And I was there for about 4 or 5 months, and then I left Crystal City and went to San Antonio.
To do what?
I was recruited by Mario Compián, who was then the chairman of the Mexican-American Youth Organization for Texas, or the Texas Mexican-American Youth Organization. And you know, it was just the Mexican-American Youth Organization in Texas, because that's where Mario was, to be the secretary, which meant that I was to handle all of the documentation, all the paperwork, the newsletter, and all communications between all the Mayo chapters that existed in Texas. So I went to San Antonio, and I was given a little office, and I was given a little printing press, and I was given a little telephone, and I got to work at keeping the Mayo network, which at that point in time was 20-some-odd youth groups throughout the state of Texas, informed and organized. And I did that, and that's what I did for a couple of years. San Antonio.
Armando Navarro, in his book, Mexican Youth Organization, says you were the president.
Well,
the last president.
Yes. The first year that I was there with Mayo as the secretary, I was the secretary. When Mario Compián finished his term as president, the following May, which would have made it in 1971, yeah, because I went to San Antonio in 1970 to run the office, the Mayo office there as secretary. When Mario decided that he was not going to run for state chairman, for the chairman of Mayo again, I decided that I was going to throw my hat in the ring for the position of chairman of Mayo, for the state. And again, that election happened in 1971. There's time, I mean, I'm sure there's some story here that needs to be told in the process, but as we approached May of 1971, I decided to run for chairman of Mayo at the annual meeting of the Mexican American Youth Organization, which happened that más o menos in May. And again, the voting or the electorate were the two Mayo board members from every one of the chapters that existed throughout Texas.
Let me go back for a couple of things.
Yeah.
Did you go to La Lomita, and what did you do there? What are your thoughts of that? And did you participate in the Cristal Walkout in 69?
La Lomita happened in the last week of 1969. At that point in time, I was living in Corpus Christi, working for SER as a pre-job, pre-vocation orientation instructor, and also doing my community organizing with the Mayo groups. I did participate in La Lomita as a technical worker within the structure of the convention. And basically, I was asked to kind of coordinate the feeding of the 600 delegates that showed up for that convention. Basically, what I was doing during the whole process of that convention was supplying, I was running to mission in Garland, brought the food stuff to feed the 600 young people that showed up at that convention. I was supplying the cook, because we hired a cook who had a group of men and young women, all Mayos, working in this kitchen, and I was given a list of everything that was to be brought every day for the meals, and I was running back and forth. That was my big involvement. I kept the food on the table for the 600 Mayo delegates that showed up. I was not in the forefront, but I was in one of the key positions for this huge convention. Again, I was not in the front of the convention, but I was feeding everybody.
Were you recruited there to go to Cristal?
I remember the presentation of the Winter Garden Project to the group, and I remember the request of volunteers that wanted to come to Crystal City and join the effort in Crystal City. And I don't remember if I was recruited by you all to go to Crystal City for that.
Okay.
I don't remember. I might have not made a commitment. I might have not told you I'll join you in whatever.
Well, when did you show up in Crystal City?
I did not show up to Crystal City until February, the first week of February of 1970. So to answer your second question, I was not at the Crystal City walkout, because I remember that the Crystal City walkout happened in late November, early December of 1969, and I was working at SER in Corpus. So I was not involved in La Lomita walk. I was not in Crystal City from La Lomita, which was in December, onwards during that, all of that, because I wasn't. La Lomita happened before, the Crystal City walkout happened before La Lomita, ¿verdad? Yes. ¿Sí o no?
Yes.
Yes. So no, I wasn't in the Crystal City. I was in Corpus Christi. I was working 8 to 5.
Have you read Navarro's book?
No.
Okay. What were some of the things you did as Secretary of Mayo?
I put out the newsletter, the Mayo newsletter, which was mine. I did that. There was a Mayo newsletter before I took over the newsletter, but I did the Mayo newsletter. My view of the newsletter was basic, keep everybody informed, and call to arms type of a newsletter. I would compose this little newsletter, which was usually either 4 or 8 pages, 6 pages, 4 to 8 little pages, double-sided printed job, and I would have information, news bits from every single chapter. So I communicated with all of the Mayos chapters throughout the state, and I would do little news blurbs. And as projects were arising, and as walkouts were happening, and as pickets were going on, I would put it out in this newsletter, and I would also mail it out to the Mayo groups throughout the state, and I had this 1-800 line, I had this telephone line that I would communicate, I would tie in the different Mayo representatives with all the other Mayo representatives when they needed to communicate with one another. So I actually was the in my mind, I was the central communications point for all of the Mayo groups in Texas, and I communicated by newsletter and by telephone, and I also facilitated movements of groups of kids, of Mayo members, from places to places, because we had the famous Mayo van, and we would move. As requests for assistance were coming in from different places, we would organize kids, and then we would take them down to the hot spot to work and help whatever was happening.
As chair of Mayo, what were some of the things that you did with the groups?
Well, I continued doing the same thing that I was doing as secretary. Because I ended up pretty much by myself. I mean, in other words, during my term, quotes unquote, during my term in as state chairman, I continued doing the same coordinating newsletter facilitating that I did as secretary. I ended up pretty much by myself. I remember Guadalupe Youngblood joined me in San Antonio to help with the keeping of the Mayo structure going after his dismissal in Corpus. He stayed there for a while longer, and then he got fired by SER. So he moved to San Antonio, and then he was helping me. But we continued putting together the Mayo newsletter and facilitating the movement of Mayo volunteers back and forth between the different spots. Like, for example, at the FAR riot unfortunately an Hispanic, Mexican-American, a Chicano got killed with Efraín down there. We sent our troops down. When the McAllen walkout, and the policemen were threatening to become violent as an effort to try and dissuade the kids to march. We got a whole big contingency of Mayos from outside the area to come in. In addition, the most important activity in the latter part of my term, quotes unquote, as Mayo chairman, state chairman, was that I became the pivotal person in my mind of trying to put together the core groups of future campaign workers to get the Raza Unida Party statewide on the ballot in Austin. Which means that I pretty much called the first organizing convention for the state Raza Unida Party, which in essence was the young dudes, and the older barrio activists to come together to San Antonio to see if we could put together a state convention that would launch an organizing drive to get the Raza Unida Party on the ballot for the 1972 election. Again, understanding that the organizing activity started in 71. And again, understanding that the organizing activities of 71 were originally pretty much kicked off as part of the overall scheme of the results of the La Lomita Convention in 1969.
Why did Mayo end?
Mayo ended because of a couple, I believe, this is my impression, of a couple of two things, two basic ideas. That were not my ideas, but that were part of, I think, of this developing, of this growing up, of a cadre of leader activists. First of all, Mayo, una de las lemas, one of the things, one of the statements that Mayo got is now still remembered from, for, is a, the classic, an organization of organizers. That, I think, had something to do with the demise or the finishing of Mayo, cuando Mayo se terminó. La segunda, the second demise of Mayo was the institution of Raza Unida Party. In the back of my mind, it's always been, I think, that we all reached our 24th, 25th, 26th year of life, and it was, and we were organizers and politicians, activists, politicians, and organizers, and we quit directing our activities with young people. And Mayo ceased when we became adults. Pretty much. In retro, we could have probably kept Mayo going if we would have been a little bit more smarter, and I'm using we in the plural. It could have very easily been an I. And not transfer the whole Mayo organization into the party organization, because in essence, Mayo ended because most of the Mayo activists, the core, the really hardcore group, became the party pushers and movers. And then we were more interested in the next campaign and the votes and working with olders, with the voters, rather than working with youth and teenagers in high schools, which was obviously Mayo, the youth. And I think that's why Mayo ended.
Let me go back and pick up the relationship with the Vista project that you alluded to. Did that continue with Mayo and the Vista Project into the future?
The Vista Project down in Corpus it was a minority mobilization project. And the Vista Project ended sometime, I don't know, Angel, I really don't remember. I left for Crystal City, but the Vista Project ended. I know for a fact that one of the activities of that particular Vista Project was to work with neighborhood youth. And I know for a fact that the Mayos that remained, that I got to see, the Mayo group, the little cadre that was going to our meetings and doing activities in Corpus, that was going to our meetings in San Antonio, remained. The Vista Project probably got terminated.
Excuse me. Síguele.
Thank you, sir.
Oye, ¿le hablamos al mismo peluquero, no?
¿Riojas por la San Berna?
Ándale, Beto.
Ándale, sir. Este... The kids remained active. Again, you know, the one that I remember the most fue Armando, ¿verdad? Because he's no longer with us. But I think the Vista Project got defunded, like most government projects that were involved in that kind of activism. Sorry, no, I don't remember much, man.
What did you do then? As Mayo ended and you became another one involved with Raza Unida, where did you go and what did you do?
At the organizational meeting of the party, I got elected secretary of the party. So for that period of time of about a year, I concentrated all of my activities at getting the Raza Unida party on the ballot, and as the secretary, I was the quote-unquote technician that tried to keep the troops out in the communities that were doing the mechanics of getting the party together legal according to the Texas election code.
Out of San Antonio?
Out of the San Antonio office, which was the state office for the state organizing office for Raza Unida party. Which meant that for about 6 months, it was a total organizing effort, having meetings throughout the state to get people to come to key state conventions in San Antonio. There was about three of them. And then during the latter part, or during the last few weeks, or the last couple of 2-3 months of the drive, of the petition drive, ¿verdad? That happened. I mean, you know, this whole concept of the petition drive was all this work coming together so that a petition could be handed to the Secretary of State to count the number of people that had signed, to certify the party and get it on the ballot so that we would appear in the November of 1972 election. So I did that activity until the last part of June of 72. At that point in time, I pretty much in my mind finished my involvement in the petition drive, quit the secretary of the party, and moved back here to Webb County in Laredo to gear up for the 1972 general election. I came back to Laredo to work as the Raza Unida party organizer for Webb County to do the 1972 election.
What was the role of your former spouse Juanita in all of these things? And when did you divorce?
Juanita became involved with me as my conyuge, as my friend, as my supporter, vice versa, mutual, ¿verdad? We were all of these things. In 1971, we met at the beginning of 1971. I was not the secretary of Mayo. I was already the secretary of Mayo. I was not the chairman. I became the chairman a few months after I met her. So during all of this activity, my chairmanship of Mayo, my organizing activity as Rasunida in the Rasunida party, she was with me all the time. Together, we worked this whole deal all throughout my chairmanship of Mayo and then into the organizing of the party. Needless to say, Juanita is a very efficient person, very, very concentrated, and did a hellacious amount of work in putting together most of the mechanisms that, that made the party happen. Women were very methodical, very methodical. You know, given that I'm a, personally, I'm just a very loose person, you know, very de ganas. And she was very methodical, and she kind of kept the whole thing together. Again, understanding that there was other people involved in this. I mean, there was, it wasn't a, I mean, it was just a lot of young people trying out new things. But as far as I'm concerned, she was right there doing all of these activities right along, coordinating much more so, probably much more so than I did in many instances. She was in the key role in todo esto.
So sometime in the summer of 72, you moved to Laredo. What did you both first do out here?
We went and opened a little office across the creek from here and opened the headquarters for Rasunida Party. And that's what we did. We didn't have a job. We opened the party and we contacted several of our friends that had indicated since, well, we did have a Mayo group here in Laredo, so we went back to the Mayo group here in town. Tiger Perez, Jorge Vasquez, his wife Chayo. We went out back to the community college with, which was then, the little club was called the Vicente Molina was the person there, the professor there, that was the, was an old friend of ours from A&I. And together with, between the old Mayo group here in town, the junior college group of young, awakening students, plus some of Ramsey Muñiz's relatives, his primos hermanos, which were also friends of ours, the Plasencias, put together the local Rasunida effort. And we had a good cadre of about 40 workers that we concentrated in putting together the 1972 electoral campaign here for the state party. And if I may add, it turned out fairly well. We received one of the highest turnouts in the state, something over 30-some-odd percent of the vote, which was, I think, very good, 30%, más o menos.
How did you do the campaign?
We were going, we did the canvassing and the posters. We did canvassing and posters. We did radio spots, and we raised funds for buying of the time on the radios, for the buying of the political poster material, and for buying the polling lists to go block work. We ended up with a very large group of young people. We, and I do mean, you know, large from my perspective, we ended up with almost 50 campaign workers during that election. 30 solids and 20 not as solid. In other words, we could always come with a group of 30 people to go out and knock on the houses or to run the silk screens, and sometimes up to 50. And we mass-produced posters that, and we produced so many posters for that election that we were not only supplying the Webb County election push, but we're also being able to ship out posters to other parts of the state where they were needed. And of course, we canvassed all of the community, every single precinct. We walked, we produced materials, handouts, and we went out and knocked on doors and talked to people, and we did the whole deal. I mean, we spent all of that fall, the latter part of summer, organizing ourselves, and all through fall, into the November election, running the streets, walking out in the streets.
Was that the first serious challenge by a party to the machine here in Laredo?
Yes, pretty much so. That was an organizing effort to go out and try and get as many votes against the Democratic Party as possible. There have always been mavericks in Laredo. Pardon the pun. There have always been mavericks in Laredo running against the machinery. One person running for a position, a county commissioner. One person. A serious political activity. The last serious political attempt was El Partido Nuevo, which happened in the mid-50s, which was a Republican Party attempt here in Laredo. That was in the mid-50s, so since then there had really not been an active political campaign against the local political machinery here in town. Yes, sir.
What happened after the defeat?
Oh, it was not a defeat. You can never have defeats in political elections. We were very enthused. We were very, 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 very glad that a group of long-haired, young, battered to the ground, because you can pretty much imagine the media. The few media that was out there was very negative, I mean, against us. I mean, this bunch of rabble-rousing, long-haired, militant, hippie, freak types, you know, que se creen, ¿verdad? How dare they? I mean, here we are talking established government, I mean, blah, 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 y andan estos alborotados haciendo borlote. You know, it was pretty bad. I mean, they, you know, the anti-Raza Unida media campaign during that election, we turned out a large number of people. I mean, a large number of people on our effort. We were ready for the next one. We were ready right around for the next one, which we did. We met, I remember, we met after the election for the what do we do now? Was very, 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 very obvious. The result was two things. We're going to organize a Centro Aztlán, and we are going to organize the election for next year. We're going to organize for the next election. Why? We had decided in all of these conventions, we had decided at La Lomita 4 years before that a political party, one of the bigger problems that political parties had was that they came around for the communities vote once every, en ese tiempo, every 4 years. And remembering the platform, remembering the statements of La Lomita, the goal statements of La Lomita, remembering the platform of the Raza Unida Party, we want to have a presence all the time in our community, and we want to do things for our community, not just come and ask for their vote once every 4 years. So Centro Aztlán was in the party's platform so that we, the party activists, could work and help our community with true del corazón activities because we're here not as politicians, but as community persons who want to lift our community. And if we cannot help our neighbors and our barrio folk with their common everyday problems, then we should not come every 4 years and do what the other political parties do and just ask for their vote, botan, and they come and they quickly turn around, go up to Washington or Austin and start passing laws that are against our people. So the grupo, el grupo de la Raza Unida, said, we're going to open the Centro Aztlán, and we had already our eyes on our original Centro Aztlán at the corner of San Eduardo and Garza, and we went out and opened it with two strategies to keep the Centro going. First, all of the campaign workers will become Centro Aztlán board members and volunteers, and that means that we're going to have a caseload. That means we're going to see people, and we're going to have our times, our volunteer hours, and we're going to go in there and help people with their problems. And two, we're going to raise funds, and we, the party activists, the ones that did the 1972 campaign, are going to raise the funds to pay the rent, the light bill, the paper, and the telephone for that storefront that is going to become Centro Aztlán. And that's how Centro Aztlán started here in Laredo. And the group became the board of directors, and we actually had fundraisers and times and schedules, and people started coming to our agency because it became an agency, a social service agency. 23 years ago. And it's never stopped. We're still here. The organization has changed very much so from the original concept, but Centro Aztlán still continues to be very active in the community, providing all kinds of services 23 years later. So Centro is still going on. The party continued for the 74 elections, 76 elections, and the 78 elections, and at that point in time, we ceased the operation of the Webb County Raza Unida Party.
Those are all partisan election dates. Did you contest any school board or city council or community college seats?
No. No. There were no Raza Unida Party activists running for city or school or community college office de la Raza Unida during that time. Why? We were always gearing up for the next election. We were always gearing up for the next election in the Raza Unida Party. See, if you remember correctly, one of the biggest controversies, and to a certain extent, one of the downfalls of the organization was that there was a group of stalwarts, me being involved in that particular group, that were always saying the party is the thing, not the candidate. There was a large group of people within the party that were saying the candidate makes the party. You remember that, those hassles. Us, the Webb County group, being who we were and what we believed, said the candidates are not important, the party's important. So we don't want to run for city, we don't want to run for school, we don't want to run because the party is important. And when the party starts winning county elections because of the party, not because of the candidate, then we'll be able to take over the schools and the city government Because everybody's, because 50% plus one are going to know the philosophy of the party and what we stand for as a huge group of human beings. So it really doesn't matter on the human being that's the candidate, because what's going to be important is not the rhetoric that the candidate is using to win his election, but that the party line is what's important. And if that candidate would ever tend to change his mind on his platform and his philosophy once he got elected, in our own sarcastic and cynic way, the party could keep him in line. So we never did that. And that was a huge controversy in the party. And it was pretty much one of the major disorganizing issues within Raza Unida Party itself, aside from the rest, but that political philosophy. And that's why we never got involved in local politics or state politics or local politics or school politics. We were always working the party, the party, the party, the party, the party.
Did the Webb County Raza Unida Party ever get more votes than they got in 72?
Never.
That was the height and the beginning of the end.
That was the height. Well, mira, the Raza Unida Party in Webb County in the 72 election, records are some here, somewhere around. I've got them at my house. All those records are there, the results, the tallies, the votes, and everything. See, we were in a different, you know, I heard your question and I'm answering in this little roundabout way. We were always, during the four campaigns, we were always in the top, we were always in the 30% turnout. So, while we got the most number of votes in 1972, we got a hell of a lot of votes in 74, a hell of a lot of votes in 76, and a hell of a lot of votes in 78, always hoping that we were getting more votes and more votes. Another thing is that we concentrated my idea and a lot of the local Webb County Raza Unida people believed that the key to the success of this party, if we were ever going to achieve success, was to concentrate all of our activities at people that didn't vote. So our political campaign that went from year to year to year to year ongoing was always going out and registering new voters and going out and knocking on the houses and doing voter registration lists of people that were not Democrats. So we believed that the only way to take over this town was to beat the Democrats by getting more non-participating registered voters to vote for our party, because we felt that convincing true red Hueso Colorado Democrats to vote for Raza Unida was not going to happen. So we never saw that kind of... We were very optimistic. We never saw it as 72 was our peak and we were going down. We knew we were going down statewide, but we were always hoping that it would pick up again. What can I say?
What do you think the consequences of the Muñiz indictment were to the party and the movement in general?
Well, that was it. That was it. Se acabó.
Soul cause?
That was the end of the party. That was the end of the party.
Well, then let's go back and pick up Centroslan. I mean, what was the... You said social services, but specifically, what did y'all start doing and how did you finance it past these fundraisers?
Still have never figured it out, though. Still have never figured it out.
What do you mean? You don't know what you do?
No, no. I was still referring to the Muñiz indictment.
Oh, I see.
The bust. To the Muñiz bust. I never figured it out. I could never figure it out. I mean, you know, I have always thought very evil things in my mind, and I've put them in the very dark recesses of my mind, not wanting to think about it, and forgotten. The centro, okay, Centroslan, very simple concept. So here we have this group of barrio cats, gente, jóvenes del barrio, jóvenes que se educaron, they left, they graduated from high school, they graduated from college. And instead of going somewhere, like everybody else, quotes unquote, before this Raza Unida cadre, 20 some odd young people, we came back to Laredo or stayed in Laredo. And not only did we stay in Laredo, we decided that we were going to stay in our neighborhoods and continue being those kind of barrio Mexicanos. That we graduated, we were educated in that system not to escape the of the barrios. That our culture in total is in the low income barrios, in the poorer barrios, in the more Spanish speaking barrios. That's where the future of our raza is. And that the Mexicano was the concept of Mexicanos living the barrio, to live in the upper world out there, being in that kind of an environment and raising their children to be like that, is helping them individually. They are concentrating all of what God gave them to better themselves personally. And that if our people are ever going to get out as a group from la miseria, con comillas, que nos encontramos, it had to be us together doing that. This concept of pulling yourself up from the bootstraps was not helping our comunidad. So the brain drain in Laredo has always been huge. You can find destacados laredenses throughout the world. Everywhere you go in this country and outside of this country, you will find born and raised Laredo ones que se han destacado y han subido hasta lo más alto en la sociedad anglosajona americana. So, la política de nosotros era, let's try and keep some of that brain in our community. It's fine for the brain drain. It's fine para que te salgas del aredo, para que levantes cabeza y desempeñes lo que Dios te dio. Pero si no lo comenzamos a hacer aquí, alguien, si una generación no comienza, va a seguir los problemas del hispano, del mexicano, del chicano, en este país y en México, en este hemisferio. So, let's start by opening a Centro Aztlán in the middle of the barrio and helping the people in these barrios with whatever problems they have. ¿Qué problema? We're college educated, right? Right. We can deal with anything in this, in the American society, right? Right. Well, let's open a Centro Aztlán so that we can abogar, being functional in the gringo world, on behalf of nuestra gente, which is supposedly our constituents, which is supposedly los votantes de la raza unida, which are gente pobre, and they are the ones that are always getting en la cabeza by el sistema, the famous el sistema. So in essence, we opened a little office of paralegals, little persons that we consider ourselves paralegals, that we would go out and advocate for la señora Ríos, el señor Garza, la señora López, el señor Montalvo, con sus problemas que estaban teniendo in dealing with whatever was out there that they were dealing with. So, viejitos would come in to Centro Aztlán with a letter from Social Security in English, wanting a translation to deal and helping us deal with that. So we would read it, and we would help Ms. Garcia type up a little letter in response to whatever there was and getting her to sign. Y muchas gracias, mijito, y cómo está tu mamá, y cómo está tu papá, y qué bueno que están aquí ayudándonos a nosotros. Y ahí nos vemos next time. So Centro was doing just very simple selladas, notarizadas, cartas, translations, problems with food stamps, recertification, questionings. So we became very good at fighting for people's benefits with the food stamp office. We became very good at fighting for people's benefits at the Social Security Administration. And we ended up getting involved with the school district. And the problem de los chamacos que los mandaban para la casa y todo eso, we began dealing with the immigration service, finding out that in Laredo, there's thousands of binational families, where they are totally American, half American, a quarter American, totally Mexican, half Mexican, quarter Mexican, in all shades of binationality. So we started finding out a lot of stuff about this whole issue of immigration. So we were dealing with people and the problems that they were having with the system. And that's originally what Centro Aztlán was about. And it has evolved a little bit, un poquito, evolved a lo que es ahora, que es pretty much still the same, but it's a little different.
How do you finance all this?
Originally, Centro Aztlán was all volunteer, so we did not have staff salaries for the first couple of years of its life. We had a large group of supporters, all in about 20-some-odd, so we would do little fundraisers where we would have little cocktail parties and carne asada plate sales and cake walks and taco sales and we'd raise the funds. Eventually, and again we're talking back in the early 70s. Eventually, we found out about fundraising and proposals and grants, and we started getting into the world of grantsmanship and. And then about 10 years ago, we discovered bingo. Given that in Texas, bingo is exclusive mostly for charitable nonprofit activities, and we receive some of our money from bingo games. We receive some of our money from shared maintenance, because we believe that the community has to share in the maintenance of organizations like Centro Aztlán, since they're the direct beneficiaries of all of these activities.
Talking about United Way? Is that what you're talking about, United Way?
No.
What's shared maintenance?
Well, people that use our services contribute money to the agency. All of our immigration services are fee for services. There has not been a funding source since the late 70s, when the federal government decided that immigrant services, that immigrants could not receive services because they were not citizens. And obviously, that's there. So we've been assessing reasonable, very reasonable fees, or like the government likes to say, nominal fees to our customers. And then government, we have a government contracts that we provide services to migrant farm workers through a government contract, a performance contract, I may add, based on service units and on performances. And that's how we keep this operation going. Fundraisers, bingos, government contracts, and fee-for-services, shared maintenance.
How many years now?
23 years. 23 years in the non-service, non-profit social service agency business. And it is a business, believe it or not. It's sometimes hairy making ends meet, making payroll and paying the light bill every month. And it's not an easy job, and it's not an easy business. But it's okay. Again, you know, we've been here for a long time, and our customers, our clients keep coming, and we do a lot of work for a lot of people that nobody does for them. And that's why we're still in business, because we're still filling in that niche. Of course, the Centro has grown in scope of services. We now provide emergency services, mostly like food boxes, emergency food boxes. Periodically, we will stave off evictions, get people off of the streets, homeless people back into a shelter, into some kind of shelter. We've been doing a lot of community development work. The cheap kind of community development work. This agency has been incubating other nonprofit organizations for the longest time. Incubating them, nurturing them, and then spinning them off so that they can fend off for themselves. Just in the last 10 years, we've spun off 7 or 8 corporations that are still alive, active, self-funded, with its own board of directors, its own organization, its own constituency, client constituency, funding constituency. And I think that that is probably the biggest impact that Centro Aztlán has done. But again, more importantly, it's got to do with a philosophy. And again, this is preaching. For some reason or another, in the last so many years, Los Chicanos have seen success in building conglomerates, organizational conglomerates, having hundreds of employees, 20 programs, 15 programs, government-funded, foundation-funded. And they become controversial, a tiny little scandal in an entity somewhere, a sexual discrimination charge, a pilfering charge, and huge empires have crumbled, where they had 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 workers, 10, 15 programs, and it's kind of disheartening for me sitting here watching what's happening out in the United States and in the Chicano community, in the Chicano world in this country, and watching organizations, social service entities, growing, becoming the chick in group with everybody, and then they disappear from the de la noche al día. So I've never wanted for this entity to become a conglomerate. The staff is, we have a staff of four. It's been a staff of four for the longest time, forever. I think for a short period of time we had a larger staff, because we had offices in Robstown, in Cotula, in Asherton. But that was just temporary. I mean, you know. So here we are, Centro Aztlán, still the same size staff-wise that it was pretty much when it started, becoming a social service agency, and we haven't grown. We haven't grown. But we've spun off a hell of a lot of nonprofit corporations, and we're still doing it. We're open. We're always open to bring in a fledgling group under our wing and try and set them straight and get them to move on and grow.
Who are some of those groups?
The Laredo Regional Food Bank. Laredo Regional Food Bank got started in 1983. It's even stronger now than ever before. It has its own board of directors. It has its own funding mechanism. It receives food donations from corporations from throughout Laredo, outside of Laredo, Sam's, Walmart, Albertsons, Caso Guerra. Local stores, farmers donate their vegetables locally, Winter Garden area. We started it, incubated here out of this agency. It's grown. Aztec Economic Development and Preservation Corporation out here in the Azteca neighborhood, they're in the process of Rafael Torres, Executive Director. They're currently right now building an apartment complex, the first development in that neighborhood, period. 50-unit apartment complex that will change the face of that neighborhood forever. Another agency, another organization that was started here, fostered here, is the Laredo Web Neighborhood Housing Services, Neighborhood Reinvestment Corporation. Again, 10, 12 years ago. It is now spun off from here. There's the five local banks involved, community residents from the target area involved. We nurtured it, we fed it, we funded it until it got enough sangrita, como decimos, so that it was viewed as a positive entity. And now it's off and running. I'm still involved on the board of directors. I'm the treasurer of that organization. But it grew. If I would have kept it under this agency, if I would have kept it under Centro Aztlán, it would have never grown. We would have never done it. It would have gone kaput. Why? Because I'm very cognizant that there's a lot of talent out there. And they always have better ideas than I do, and it's worked. Right now, I'm working with a very small community group out in El Cenizo, which is one of the incorporated colonias out here in Webb County. We're trying to get them stabilized. Their accounting system, their bookkeeping system is not in place. The classical shoebox operation. They're supposed to be doing housing and community development out in a very difficult area. Very little infrastructure, very little income in the community. We're trying to get them up to par, up to that kind of par. Trying to see if we can get some contracts for them. Great. If it spins off, there is a group of community residents there that make up the board of directors, and they're going to remain there. If this organization really kicks off and we get some money in there, that community organization is going to remain there as a viable political force in that particular community. And that's what we're talking about, leaving things behind Luera Sigo trip got busted many years ago, and sometimes I get in trouble for not being too ego, having too much of an ego. I'm always getting in trouble because people would want for me to be more exciting.
Do you own the building now under Central Slum?
The organization is bought this building in 1986. We owned the building. It was an unfortunate situation. It was repossessed from a family that had been here already for three generations in this little pedacito de tierra. We had nothing to do with it. I mean, again, we knew the family here. But we became aware that the building was vacant 6-7 months after the family had already vacated the building. And through our board chairman then was just so happened to be drinking coffee with a bank officer. And in conversation, we found out that this building was defaulted. It was a savings and loan. It was just before the SNL scandal, you know, in 86. And they offered them that they had this building available and it would look good for them if they let a private nonprofit assume the total note and everything. So we very easily went into the assuming of the building. And we've been paying a note now since 1986, and we've been here since 1986, and we own the building.
How many citizens have you made over the years?
A thousand citizens easily. With a thousand citizens that I can safely say that we know for a fact that we've made. But again, everything is a very much of a trickling situation. It's a trickling effect. Understanding families the way they are and the immigration policies of the United States, once you make a citizen, you open the door for the whole family to become immigrants, legal immigrants, and then legal citizens.
Do you do any political asylum work?
We did a lot of political asylum work, especially during the Central American problem. We saved thousands of Salvadoreños and Guatemaltecos and Hondureños, and it makes me feel damn good.
Do you do any?
Thousands. And we got him out of here. Fast. Got him out of here. Understanding that political asylum cases are not won. You don't win political asylum cases. We were just so lucky that Laredo was a key entry point. And the way the system works, the way the immigration system works, and the way that political asylum deal works, is that this age we were able to do a lot because we got them, we processed them, and we sent them out to where they were going, whether it was Washington, D.C., or Houston, or Boston, or Dallas, or Los Angeles, or Chicago. In other words, we were lucky that we did so many because we were not bogged down with the legal case itself. We would get them again, we would get them released, and then we would transfer their legal case to another voluntary agency, whether it be in Dallas or Washington or Chicago, any other nonprofit agency that was representing asylum cases, and we would get them, we would move the people from here to over there, usually in most cases already with a work authorization permit. And that continues. See? Political asylum, you win or you lose when you try them in court. We here never got to any political asylum court because we would transfer the cases to somebody else's district. So we saved a lot of folk.
With all these people that you work with now, do you still do any electoral work?
I think it's my wife.
Rafa.
No. Wait. How can I answer that question?
I don't know, but we've got about 5 minutes.
Alberto Luera does very, very, very little political work, electoral. I do personally almost practically no electoral work at all, personally. I don't. The last political activity involvement that I did, aside from, well, was your election for U.S. Senator. Before that was my involvement with Jim Hightower for the three elections that he very much involved. I was involved in Jim Hightower's race for the Department of Agriculture and for the Senate election. And then your election for U.S. Senate, I have not become, I physically am not involved in electoral politics.
How does the politics in Webb County work now? Who's the power structure? What do they do?
In 1996, if you were to sweep the faces of all of the politically elected officials, their main assistants, their key supporters, regardless of what anybody says, regardless of what they of how they view their personal politics and how much they might think that things are not the same now as they were 30 years ago, I can still see the same machinations that existed in the late 60s and early 70s, now, with the next generation of people that were... Now in politics we find grandsons, sons and grandsons, and daughters and granddaughters of the políticos that were involved in that old Partido Viejo politics. And again, I've always prided myself as sitting in an armchair, viewing out into our community without really any malice, and non-maliciously, you can look and say, look at that guy. Well, that guy is el hijo de this guy who was en esta administración, esta persona, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, and you can track down how City Hall is governed by the sons and daughters and granddaughters and grandsons of the people that were there during the Martin era.
Who are the more influential Mexican-American leaders today?
Where?
Texas.
In Texas? In Texas?
Yes.
The more influential, in which term are you asking for influence? ¿Cómo dices influential?
You got 3 minutes. You define it. Who are the most effective leaders? Who are the best leaders? Who are the most well-known leaders? Who are your leaders? Define it and give an answer if you can.
Obviously, the biggest Hispanic names in Texas right now are Cisneros, Peña, in the cabinet of the president. The more influential, the most influential Hispanics in Texas sit in the legislature, and especially in the Senate. Those are the most influential Hispanics right now. Of course, our state-elected Attorney General, very influential. The senators, Truan, Zaffarini, Uribe, because of the amount of power they do in writing laws, and of course the Hispanic caucus of the Mexican-American caucus of the legislature. They're the most influential. Local elected officials, I don't see them. But I'll tell you one thing. it's easy to be an Hispanic elected official in Houston or Dallas or in those major metropolitan areas. It is extremely difficult to be an Hispanic elected official in a predominantly Hispanic community like Laredo. Those people out there that are elected officials in the Dallas, Houston, Austin would never get elected in a town like this. My leaders, my personal leaders, I am avoiding the issue heavily.
Let's talk about organizations.
Lack of words. I don't have any words to say who my leaders are.
Talk about organizations. Who are the most effective organizations today for Mexican Americans?
I think that organizations right now in 96, effective Mexican American organizations are waning. There's some serious happenings that were because of our own doing. We're seeing a rapid demise of MALDEF to align to the Democratic Party, and it's doing it in. Southwest voter registration to align with the Democratic Party, they're not getting any funds. There's basically no grassroots organizations. We really don't have farm worker, the AFL. I mean, the unions are practically non-existent, especially Hispanic unions. Cesar Chavez and his farm worker union is non-existent in Texas. There is an attempt at National Council of La Raza to be the premier Hispanic organization in this country. Again, media is saying that. I see the effort active, but limited. That's it. I don't see anything else out there. LULAC is pretty much gone. Their infighting is incredible. Their ego trips among themselves are horrendous. Jerry Forum is, unfortunately, World War II veterans are practically extinct now. They're all pushing their late 70s and 80s. They're dying off.